discussion groups as well, so opportunity for us all to move around and have some discussions, but to take us into the materiality session, we have a team of three, I think, here, Aileen, Christy and Alan, taking us through materiality. And we decided she was only allowed 8 seconds because of the copyright rules. I Googled it.
I am not a material girl. We're keen to get you back on track in terms of time as well. We've got quite a big presentation here because we gave you all the material that we gave to our board, and I could say tongue-in-cheek, we tried to work out which bits were material for the discussion purposes this afternoon. Essentially, we're going to go through the slide deck reasonably quickly, and there are little bits that we're going to jump through because we don't think they're necessary to help answer the questions, but there are three themes that we're going to talk about. The first is about the concept of materiality generally. Okay, so that's materiality as a concept that's used by us, by auditors, by other people, including outside the context of financial reporting. Sorry?
Madonna,
exactly. So the general idea of materiality. The second thing is about how it applies in the financial reporting context, the things that we do. And then the third part is, what sort of steps we should take and what we can take to improve how materiality is applied and how we can perhaps get some others to change their behaviours as well, because we think that's part of the problem. So we're going to, if you can skip through to slide number five, Christy will start off with some general characteristics.
So what is materiality? And on this slide, we're trying to describe what we think some of the characteristics are, because materiality is an abstract concept. It's not something you can touch or feel or directly see. It does describe a decision to include something or exclude something, so it acts as a filter. And I think the idea that it's abstract and requires a decision leads you to see that it requires judgment. It's not something that is a clear answer one way or the other. And materiality is also based on the substance of something, and we call that substance material, but ultimately it's about what do you think that the substance of that item has in terms of what it's trying to do. And finally, it applies within different contexts, and we heard Madonna talking about it there, but you know, materiality can be used in different ways. I've heard it talked about in the context of art. We definitely hear it more close to home in the context of corporate reporting more generally, but bringing it down in the context of management reporting and financial statements more generally. And I think the way you apply it, you know, is very much determined by the context that it sits in. But aside from all that, people tend to be able to use it quite broadly in the same way. So we think there is broad agreement about what that general concept means. So if I move to the next slide, and this is really trying to give you an illustration, which the actual one that I'm wanting is not coming up, but it is a map of the tube, which is not there at all. But the person who did the tube map, for anybody getting around London, realises that still not there. The tube map really was designed by the person providing it to give you the information that you needed to know for a particular purpose, to get around London via the tube. And it didn't need all the detail, which was in the more detailed map, which is on the right-hand side of the slide. And I think Alan has an example he quite likes to use, which is the job one, which is in the next slide.
Yeah, just as a general idea, you know, if you're trying to make a decision about hiring somebody, you need to know, you don't want the whole life story. You need to know the salient points about perhaps the skills that match the job they're applying for, a little bit about their character, things like that. And the thing is that, you know, if you think about this negatively, let's say you made a bad hire decision, and the example I might use is, you know, let's say somebody I employed actually assaults me at work, and then you find out that they've been fired from three other jobs for assaulting their managers as well, and they didn't disclose that. That's just information that I would have liked to have known in advance rather than in arrears. And you'd go back and review, you want to make sure that information was there, or if it was there, you know, if it's a 500-page application that was buried in some footnote, that's equally as bad. And really all we're doing is applying the same context to financial reporting. Three things you need to know, and this will apply again as we get to financial reporting. what type of decision are you trying to make? Okay, so in the hire case, it's hiring somebody for a job. It's a fairly easy decision. For us in financial reporting, we're asking what type of decision you make in that context. You then need to know something about your decision maker. So if you're applying for a job, or in this, in the case of financial reporting, who's reading your financial statements? That's going to be very important as well. So what type of decision, what type of decision maker? Very critical things for us. So I think now turn to slide 11.
So here we're looking at why we're looking at materiality, and we have been told that materiality is part of the disclosure problem, but I think it contributes that to disclosure problem in a number of ways. And what we're trying to illustrate in this slide is what we want to concentrate on in the materiality project is the ways that people have problems applying materiality in the context of financial reports. So what about IFRS is making materiality difficult to apply? So in that context, we see a lack of understanding of the general concept. People seem to be unclear how to apply it. So what do I need to tell an investor? And then, as we've indicated earlier, sometimes our standards aren't helpful in helping people apply materiality. The other two bullets or the boxes really sort of indicate where we think materiality is being a problem, well, what is causing a problem applying materiality, which is maybe a bit more outside of what the ISB can deal with directly, which is behaviour. There's an asymmetric caution about applying materiality. It's better to put something in than leave something out. And also there seems to be time and resource constraints that sort of mean that people often disclose more information rather than take it out. And finally, I think there's this idea of understanding a user. We hear that sometimes it's difficult for a preparer to make a decision about what a user might need to consider when making a disclosure. So there seems to be some uncertainty or some a gap between what users want and what preparers seem to want to be able to give or can give or understand what they need. So if I move to that's sort of giving you a sense of the problems that we're looking at in the materiality project. I think maybe if Aisling's going to go through what we've actually done already in terms of our research.
So hello. I'm very briefly going to take you through the research that we've carried out. So we're on slide 13. We've carried out discussions with representatives of IOSCO and the IAASB in setting the scope for our work. They're also working on materiality. So we're going to continue to monitor each other's work and, if at all possible, to move in a similar direction. We also wrote to national and regional standard setters to ascertain how materiality is used in their documents and what challenges they face using materiality in their regulatory environment. Internally, we carried out a review of academic papers, requirements by regulators, industry papers, case law, guidance given by the big accounting firms. And we've also had discussions with academics and practitioners. And all this is really just to try and understand the breadth of understanding that there is of materiality and how it's used and problems that occur in its use. So if we move on to slide 14, you can see the description that we have in the conceptual framework. So there's three important things to take away from this that influence our discussion. The first thing is that it's information pertaining to a decision. That decision is made by a user, and it's entity-specific. So these three things drive our understanding of materiality and will colour whatever outcome comes out of this research project. So on slide 15, we've listed the sources that we've looked at for materiality. Just to go into them a bit more. Legally, we expected to come across a lot more case law than actually we did. The major case comes from America, where materiality was defined by the US Supreme Court. But we also came across a case from New Zealand, which defines the user. So New Zealand being a common law jurisdiction, this case is persuasive precedent in about a third of the world's jurisdictions. We also had an interesting conversation with a lady in the French standard setter, and I discussed with her the consequences of something being defined within a civil law jurisdiction and whether that definition comes from statute, the court, or by a regulatory body. So this is important because civil law accounts for the other two-thirds of the world's legal systems. So whatever we as the IFRS Foundation produce at the end of this project, it is important to remember that the courts will be the final arbiter of materiality, and that we'll have to work, our definition will have to work within their systems. We also looked at, there's more than one definition within the IFRS. There's another one in IAS1 and IAS8. There's a materiality definition within auditing and other corporate reporting, and as Christy alluded to, it's a commonly used phrase. So in carrying out this research, we discovered that most definitions, be it local regulators or organisations like the IAASB, use very similar definitions to ours. They're predominantly judgment-based and entity-specific, and they pertain to decisions about providing economic resources. There are other tests. These tend to be tests used by courts, and they look at things like fraud on the market, effect on the share price, or voting decisions as suggesting that something was, as the piece of information was material. And then there are jurisdictions that have bright line thresholds. For example, one national standard setter replied and said that materiality is 3% of total revenue or currency unit amount. So it's important to remember that there are different understandings of materiality, and hopefully moving forward we'll be able to bring these together.
And one of the basic questions we asked is in fact, as Aisling says, whether we need a definition or not. The example you see on page 17 is a classic case, and because it's the US, it's actually a relatively big jurisdiction. Every time we raise the issue of materiality and we have US people in here, their arms, hands go up, or their cards will go up, and they want to say you've got to be very careful. Because as Aisling says, the Supreme Court in the US has defined materiality. Within the US, within the Accounting Standards Codification, the FASB's documentation, they do not define materiality. The place you find it is the Securities Act 1933, and there's no definition. And that's, as Aisling said, it's developed out of a Supreme Court definition. In other countries, they will rely on what we have, for example, and you'll see that the IFRSs are actually built into the local regulation. So by construction, our definition becomes part of the local regulations. So you get different types of environments, some that don't need a definition because they have their own. The more we do, this is one of our questions you'll see, the more we do, the chances are you're going to end up either colliding or having some sort of conflict with the local regulation. So we actually have asked that basic question, do we need a definition? I think it's fair to say in some jurisdictions that are newer to IFRS that don't have this as a concept, then it might be more helpful. In other jurisdictions where it's far more mature in terms of application, it could be a difficulty in applying it. Interestingly, there are, for the foreign filers in the US, those who are file with the SEC but prepare under IFRS, they will be applying, presumably, and following our definition of materiality, but they're actually filing within a US regulatory environment under the 1933 Act. So it's interesting how those are able to at least gel together for the moment.
So now we'll move on to general materiality principles and how they apply in financial reporting. And actually there's a few slides here, and I think they're well summarised if we move to 25, which is the diagram. And ultimately, I think what we're trying to describe here is how materiality works and the various components of a materiality decision. So I think firstly we've got here a context, and I think as we've described, you've got to consider what context are you deciding to use materiality in. In financial reporting, obviously it's the financial report. could be the financial statements, it could be the primary financial statements, or it could be the notes or a part of the notes. And I think depending on where you're making that decision and the objectives that sit around that decision will definitely guide you in determining what sort of information is needed and for what purpose. It actually underlies some of the work we're doing in the Principles of Disclosure project, where we are really wanting to bed down in a bit more detail what is the purpose of the notes, what is the purpose of the primaries, because then it drives a bit more in a bit more detail how we think an entity might be able to apply materiality. You then move on to the user, and you need to have some sense about who your user is. In financial reporting, obviously, we're guided by the definition in the conceptual framework, but we've got to have some expectation about what they already know and what they would expect to be able to receive, because that will determine how much information we give. And in particular, if we're talking about a particular matter, what information would you expect to see about that matter? And that's relevance, and that's where I think the ISB can really step in and be clearer, particularly about what information about a matter is relevant, and then the entity uses that idea of its context, its user, to determine what is material or relevant information. And then I've got to hear context again, and everybody goes, haven't you got too many contexts in, or one extra context? And really what I want to sort of illustrate there with the additional context is that at some point I think you need to step back and look at the picture as a whole, and whether the item that you're proposing to include or exclude would make a difference to that overall picture.
Yeah. Can I just emphasise two things there? I'm on the Integrated Reporting Council's Task Force on Materiality, and we're trying to work with exactly the same definition that we've got here for integrated reporting, and yet that's supposed to be a smaller report than you have as a major financial report. And the difference is the context. If you describe the purpose of the integrated report and describe the purpose of the financial report, because they have slightly different purposes, you'll end up with different amounts of information in there. So that's why we think that this general notion is pretty well understood.
I think at that point, I think in the slide deck, we might have a question for the ISB, but it does also mark a point where there is one question that we'll be asking you for the breakouts that we'd want to concentrate on. So I'll just mention that now, but then we'll move forward into the slide. But we would be asking you, that the ISB defines or describes materiality in the conceptual framework. But should the ISB even have this definition? I mean, given that it seems to be well understood, seems to be used in different jurisdictions, in different contexts, do we even need to have that definition of materiality, or could we just use the term? I think the second question, if the ISB does need a definition, does the ISB need a definition, or should this be the responsibility of securities regulators? So that's sort of if we take what we've just described, sort of the question that we wouldn't mind getting some feedback on in the breakout sessions. But having said that, I'll just move quickly on to the next part of the presentation, which is about application problems that we hear about materiality. If I move to the next slide about what we've heard, In a summary, we've heard different things. Some people want us to do more, to provide more guidance. Other people say that actually it's a behavioural issue, or it's something that's outside of the remit of the ISB, and therefore you shouldn't do anything more. People know how to apply materiality. It's ultimately a behavioural question. But in terms of, we think there are some things that are more directed at the ISB that we think we may be able to do something about. In particular, on slide 29, drafting in IFRS, sometimes the language we use around our disclosures is more prescriptive than perhaps allows a good exercise of materiality. So we often say when we disclose or require something to be disclosed, an entity shall disclose, or an entity at a minimum shall disclose, and it's sometimes difficult to then overlay the concept of materiality to something quite a strict requirement. We often use different terms that we think might mean the same thing as materiality, or may not mean the same thing as materiality, because I don't think we're clear. Things like significant, sufficiently material, or most important. And I think if we could be clear about if we meant material to say material, if we didn't mean material, what differentiates those terms from material. If I move to slide 30. That's Alan.
Me. Relevance. Christy mentioned relevance as well. One of the examples we've taken to our board, if I asked you today, tell me what do you think makes an accounting policy relevant to an entity? What's the important feature? And we've done a lot of asking around about that, and it depends which group you go to. So the UK, the reporting lab's done some interesting work. Apparently revenue is the answer for one. The revenue policy we had that this morning is always important, but it's considered by some. Some people think it's whether it's a big number that you're dealing with. Others think it's a matter of whether there's judgment, whether there's accounting choice. Lots of different factors that might be there. The problems that we are addressing in IS1 at the moment as part of our short-term fix is actually says if you pay tax, then you should disclose your tax policy. So it almost implies everything is important. Now, if we can't agree on what makes something relevant or something important generally, then how can somebody in their own organisation work out which one is material? Okay, so what we're trying to do is to clarify, because our worry is that what happens is that if you don't know what makes an accounting policy relevant, just disclose all of them. The relevant ones are bound to be in there somewhere, and it doesn't help you filter down. And that's why we think we get 6 pages or more of accounting policies. So it's not just accounting policies, but you go through any particular standard for disclosure requirements. The clearer we make the objective and the clearer we can set out why it is that information helps you in your assessment, whether that be helping you predict cash flows, help you make some sort of judgment, the clearer that relationship is, the more you can actually focus and work out what it is you have to disclose. And it won't necessarily just be the numbers or things on the list. You might have to go further than that to meet that objective. So we think that we can improve the way we express our standards by being much clearer about what makes information relevant. That's what the ISB is supposed to be, is experts in accounting, is identifying what in a given time. And you know, we swap examples. I use agriculture. You know, in agriculture, I want to know if you've got value changes, is it through growth or is it through changes in the actual amounts you can sell the amounts for, and explain that quite clearly.
In the next slide, we talk about another common application problem or an issue that comes up in a lot of discussions about materiality, and that's the interaction of qualitative and quantitative assessments of materiality. And ultimately, I think we think that materiality is a qualitative assessment, and a quantitative aspect of it is just one quality, and often is actually a very important and definitive decision about materiality, but that's not always the case. We think that stating materiality in the context of quantitative thresholds or amounts, though, could cause bright lines, which would then discourage judgment, cause boilerplate disclosures, or create a false sense that if you didn't meet that bright line, then something wasn't material. We're also conscious that even the way we write disclosures with a list of requirements could in some ways be seen as creating a bright line. But ultimately, we think quantitative assessments are important, but then they're only one quality of ultimately a qualitative assessment. And in terms of other factors that have sort of contributed to application problems of materiality, we think that materiality differs obviously between entities and periods, so therefore it changes. It will always be shaped by you, the entity, and its context, so therefore it's subjective, it's entity specific, it's professional judgment, it's hard to pin down. And it can mean different things to different people, and it actually most probably has to, given that it has to apply in a lot of different contexts and jurisdictions. And I think the other thing is that some information is more important than others, which does create a perception that there are different levels of materiality. I think we actually think materiality is a binary concept. It's something's either material or it isn't, but it does change depending on what context you're actually assessing that judgment in. So if I move to the next section, which is... there's a simple description, but there's the This is a quote I quite like, and Hicks, I think, had quite a few good quotes about materiality, but if it doesn't really matter, don't bother with it. And in some ways, you think of all the work that we do and all the definitions we have, sometimes a simple quote like that does sum up what materiality means. But I think at this point, again, the next slide on the slide deck was a question for the ISB. But it does mark where we think there is a question that we gave you for the breakout sessions, which sort of sums up what we've just discussed. So how can the ISB help people to exercise judgment in applying materiality? Do you think the problem is that people come from differing backgrounds and are struggling to deal with a judgment-based system? Is the lack of clarity within the financial reporting standards about how to apply it in a particular context, such as the notes? So that's sort of the question that we'll ask you to answer in the breakout session as well, sort of related to the applying materiality. But if I move now to the ISB response, and slide 37 gives you an overview of some of the outreach we've been undertaking. So we have been consulting broadly with the ISB in September, the World Standards Setters, ASAF, and now with yourselves. But we really want to get... We are actually getting quite supportive views, though somewhat mixed in terms of... guidance. If I think of the ISB discussion, there was definitely mixed views of whether the ISB needed to produce additional guidance or not. I think there was more support in ASAF and World Standard Setters. Those who supported additional guidance, it's not clear what form that guidance would take. I think there was more support if I got in the context of World Standard Setters or ASAF for looking at the definition of materiality. So there is some sense that perhaps the definition isn't quite right and maybe it should be aligned more closely with, say, that's used in the US. There maybe should be a greater focus on including information, just not omitting information, and also a sense that the definition of a user is very broad, so therefore it makes it difficult to make a materiality decision. If I then go to possible approaches that we could take, and these will be the recommendations that we'll be asking the board in September. Now, this is just a list of possible at the moment. We haven't come up with what our recommendation is yet. But we could recommend education material on materiality. That could be something that's purely educational, so a staff paper. The other things we've been talking about, which is more... actual guidance, which could be a practice statement or application guidance. That form has not been determined and will obviously be dictated to a certain extent by the amount of due process we would like around anything that we produced on materiality if it was decided that something was needed. We also, on page 42, we also think... we could produce some guidance for the ISB. Again, this gets back to this drafting guidance I was talking about earlier, about how we might draft more clearer, succinct disclosure requirements. So that's the objectives, and then also how we structure disclosure examples or requirements related to that objective. And then finally, as I mentioned, we could look at the definition of materiality in IFRS. to ensure that it doesn't conflict with other jurisdictions and where we have it in IAS itself.
So, just to wrap up, I think that we are getting slightly mixed signals, but there are some jurisdictions and perhaps where that's been well developed and some mature analysis tell us to act cautiously and don't step on toes, basically. But there are lots of other jurisdictions that have got less developed definitions and less developed practice, I think, might benefit from some extra guidance. And so for us, that's one of the questions we're asking of you, and it relates back to a discussion we had last year. I think it was last year, I've lost track now, about education material versus guidance and so on.
Alan, I'm just going to interrupt you. The questions that you're asking are in the original
paper.
Covering memo on page four.
So maybe the form matters in that if you think about trying to lift up information, or else in the case of a practice statement, it may be that says if a jurisdiction doesn't have their own definition or application guidance, you can draw on that, and another jurisdiction may decide just to keep their own, for example. And that creates interesting issues about IFRS being a global standard, for example. But the last little leg in this is that no matter what we do, we still need to think about behaviour within the system. And I have been critical at times of I have seen some regulators who will publish essentially a compliance statement indicating how many disclosures were complied with on a particular topic, and that must give a signal that you have to tick the box. So if a regulator is applying a checkbox approach to it, then that's a worry for us, because it means that no matter what we do in terms of the way we write, if they're being enforced in a checkbox mentality, it creates a bit of a problem. So we're looking for ideas from you about how we ought to engage. Should we, we had our disclosure forum nearly 18 months or so ago. Do we need to try and pull together all of the stuff on materiality, for example, and do more of that work and engage and get people talking? Because we've seen some good results from our first forum, we think, with the way people behave. It sounds like bad behaviour, but the way people have actually got some good ideas for financial reporting. Perhaps this could be a catalyst for even more, for example. So we'd really welcome your feedback on that.
On that note, I suggest that we break into the breakout groups. As I said, the questions that the team are putting to us, unless anyone has any really high-level queries, I do encourage us to go to our breakout groups. And I'm quickly looking around the table, and the answer seems to be no. So page 4 of the covering memo, in terms of the questions, you have on your desks the breakout groups and where you are supposed to head. And I think 2 groups are in here and 2 are in rooms that I don't have a clue where they are, but no doubt we'll find them. And suggest that we do have the full hour that we were allocated for this, because I think it's very important discussion. So if we can please, and there's coffee in the rooms, so for afternoon tea, please be back here for the next session at 3:45. So I'm going to let you go. And then, as a reminder, that the chairs of each of those groups to report back after the next session on corporate reporting. So you have that session there to pull together your notes to report back to the full group. Okay? Any queries? Questions? Let's go.